May it please the court, Mr. Goodman, Mr. Allen. In this case, respondent violated the professional duties owed to his client, to the legal profession, and to the legal system. He did so by knowingly filing false affidavit with the trial court and failing to timely remedy the misstatements contained in that affidavit in violation of Rule 4-3.3. He made misstatements of fact to an opposing party and their counsel in violation of Rule 4-4.1. The panel who heard this case concluded that he engaged in deceitful and dishonest behavior in violation of Rule 4-8.4C. Finally, respondent failed to timely correct his false affidavit and failed to properly prepare for the deposition of his medical expert witness, thereby violating the diligence rule 4-1.3. This court has historically relied upon a system of progressive discipline to assess the appropriate sanction for attorneys who violate the rules of professional conduct. Likewise, the ABA standards for imposing lawyer sanctions support the use of progressive discipline as a sanction tool.
Do you think the DHP found that he intentionally filed a false affidavit knowing it was false at the time he filed it?
Judge Breckenridge, they found the violation of 8.4C. I tried to parse that finding because, frankly, I'm not sure that there was sufficient record evidence that he filed that false affidavit with intent to deceive.
But does that make a difference?
I think it would make a significant difference in terms of the sanction. If it's under the ABA standards, if it were intent to deceive the court, the ABA sanction standard 6.11 calls for disbarment.
And we have we are finding ourselves. And so what evidence is there that would show that it was an intentional making of a false affidavit at the time it was made that to support the sanctions that you are requesting? Or do you think that finding is necessary to support the sanctions you're requesting?
Well, let me skip to what we believe is appropriate, which is this actual suspension. Our belief is that it calls for a actual suspension. We recommend a year actual suspension, not probation. We did not, frankly, concur in the 8.4C finding of intentional intent to deceive the court. What we did think was that the respondent knowingly filed a false affidavit. That affidavidunder Section 538.225 required the affidavit be filed stating the counsel had a written opinion from a doctor to the standard of care of the defendant doctor, that there was negligence involved.
And he only had one written opinion?
I believe he had two, but the one that concerned Dr. Matthews was the opinion of Dr. Schmitz. He had no written opinion from Dr. Schmitz, and in fact, in his conversations with Dr. Schmitz prior to filing the affidavit, I don't think he ever asked the question, do you even have an opinion? Because what happens is 15 months later, everyone picks up and travels to Terre Haute, Indiana, and for the first time, I believe the respondent finds out in his pre-meeting with Dr. Schmitz that he doesn't even have an opinion about Dr.
I think
Matthews.
He admits that he messed up that case and didn't prepare adequately and that may be subject to sanction, but he's saying it was a diligence and sort of competence issue in that particular case that does not merit actual suspension. I'm taking it from what you're arguing that were this the first time he'd come before OCDC, you might agree, but you're concerned he went from admonition to state suspension and that something less than a real suspension might not be effective.
I think you have to separate the 3.3 knowing falsification to the court from the diligence violation for a moment. In our view, the knowing misconduct, the violation of 4-3.3 under the ABA standard standing alone calls for suspension. And in this case,
but does it address whether it's state or not?
Exactly. It does not address whether it's state or not. However, in this case, he clearly knew, I don't have a written opinion, yet I'm going to file this affidavit required under the statute and just hope, I guess, no one finds out. He goes up to Terre Haute, finds out that the doctor not only doesn't have a written opinion, he doesn't even have an opinion.
Yeah, I was going to say, you might think it was knowing, but the total failure to prepare almost is healing in the sense that it shows it was neglect.
Well, and so let me address the 4-1.3 violation then, if I can, because that's where I think progressive discipline comes into play, the diligence. The fact is that since 1992, we have a history of admonitions, reprimand from this court, and probation, all involving violations of 4-1.3. And so in my view, the diligence aspect of this case is where you need to think about applying progressive discipline and finding that he simply hasn't learned from the prior admonitions issued by our office.
Are there any mitigating factors like alcohol or substance?
Judge Fallman, in mitigation, I would say that respondent has cooperated with the discipline system in terms of and has had a cooperative attitude towards the discipline system. He's acknowledged, as Judge Stith said, that he messed up. He messed up big time. So I think that's a mitigator. In terms of any other overlay to the case, I'm not aware of anything.
I was actually impressed that he argued on appeal, don't blame my clients, blame me, that he admitted to the other side and called them up. He did not file something directly with the court, but he admitted in court that he'd messed up. He did a lot of mea culpa, and he's not tried to evade responsibility, and he's tried to take the responsibility on himself. Those are certainly mitigators.
He has accepted responsibility once confronted with a motion for sanctions from Dr. Matthews.
Prior to being caught, even though he still knew he didn't have an affidavit all the way up to the time they went for the deposition.
Right. He knew he didn't have a written affidavit for 15 months, never took steps to go get that written opinion, at least correct that omission. But once faced with a motion for sanctions, yes, he frankly fell on his sword and said, yes, this was all my mess up. You shouldn't sanction my clients for my misdeeds. And in fact, the court ultimately, the Phelps County Trial Court, ultimately enters sanctions against the respondent in the amount of $62,000, none of which has been paid, to my knowledge.
Does OCDC have a position on whether it believes Mr. Allen was then aware all this time and aware he hadn't sent the x-rays and aware he didn't have an affidavit and just went there hoping for the best at the depot, or whether he just dropped the ball and got there and went, whoops, I forgot to cover my bases.
Right. I think he clearly knew that he didn't have a written opinion from Dr. Schmitz.
I mean, it was in the forefront of his mind, as opposed to he should have known, because he sure never had one before and he didn't get one.
Well, I don't know.
Was that argued? Was that addressed below?
I think it was pretty self-evident. I think he readily admitted before the panel and previously to the Phelps County Trial Court, I filed a false, knowingly filed a false document, knowingly filed an affidavit that was false. He knew he didn't have a written opinion in his file. I think the assumption that even though he had spoken with Dr. Schmitz, that Dr. Schmitz would support a finding of negligence against Dr. Matthews. He goes up to Terre Haute and has that pre-deposition meeting and finds out, oh, he doesn't have any opinion because I haven't given x-rays to the doctor. But he lets the deposition proceed and they come to learn. Everyone comes to learn, not only do I not have an opinion, but I've never given the respondent an opinion to that effect. So that's when the dominoes start falling. But the fact is there's a lengthy period of time where he could have and should have corrected that false affidavit. And so you call that diligence, call it knowing misconduct, but if it's diligence, it's severe lack of diligence. And with the history that we have here, I think that's where progressive discipline comes into play, and you have to think about actual suspension.
What was his
probation.
State suspension? Was a six-month state suspension previously?
Yes, I believe that's correct. It was a six-month state suspension, and he went to ethics school in 2010.
When did all this occur?
Great question. This actually predated the probation. This conduct occurred. The affidavit was filed in 2006. He was put on probation actually in 2009. Yes, that's a significant factor. But nevertheless, it falls in the timeline of just a lot of diligence violations, frankly. He went to ethics school, completed the probation successfully, comes off probation. Right about the same time he's filing to have the probation lifted is when we vote the information and decide to go forward with the information.
Are there any other pending complaints at this time? Are we allowed to ask that?
Probably not, but there aren't. There aren't.
I mean, anything as to which an information is, when it's up to the public point.
No, ma'am. No, Judge, there isn't. Judge Tidelman, you asked about mitigators, and I do think there has been a cooperative attitude. There are also aggravators. The prior disciplinary history, obviously, is an aggravator. There is a pattern of misconduct, as shown by the prior history as well as this case. There are multiple offenses in this case that are present that were found by the panel, and the respondent has substantial experience in the practice of law, which under the ABA standards is also an aggravating factor.
The disciplinary hearing panel is recommending the same discipline that he received in 2009. Is that correct?
That's correct. They after finding the violations, including the deceit violation 8.4C, they recommended a state suspension with probation. We rejected based on the sanction they were recommending, but we also frankly questioned the 8.4C violation. I think it's knowing misconduct, but I'm not fully on board with the fact that this was intentional deceit.
Is there any indication that they recommended the same suspension because of the timing of the violation?
I don't think so. I think Mr. Goodman did a really good job in front of the panel, I guess. I don't know. I don't think it had to do with the timing of the sanction.
Well, it kind of goes, the reason progressive discipline is imposed, as you kind of indicate, is that if an admonition doesn't work, it used to be people could get many admonitions, but we move up to a reprimand. If that's not successful, move up to a state suspension and so forth. But since this conduct occurred prior to his state suspension, we don't have that he didn't respond to the state suspension. In fact, he hasn't had anything since that. So is some of the reasons why you'd look at progressive discipline being then regular suspension, do they apply fully when the conduct was prior to the prior state suspension?
If it were only one discipline and this conduct predated that discipline, I'd say progressive discipline doesn't apply.
What if this was heard at the same time of the prior incident? Would you be recommending an actual suspension based upon the 4.33?
If it were at the same time, I'd say he at least has knowledge. He's under probation. He's engaging in additional conduct. I'd say probably there's a stronger argument
that it applies. If this charge was brought at the same time as the other one,
that it resulted in the state suspension, so he had all these things at
one time. Addition to what he was facing, if this was part of it and we had this knowingly false affidavit, would you have recommended it?
If I understand what you're asking, Judge Fisher, if we had known about this conduct when we filed the charge that led to the probation, we would not have agreed to a state suspension and probation. We would have asked for an actual suspension then. If we had known about the conduct in a timely fashion during the time of this probation, we would have asked that probation be terminated based on this conduct and that the actual suspension that this court had already imposed come into play. What happened, the timing had to be such that the regional committee in St. Louis voted the information about the same time the respondent files to have the probation lifted, and we just decide to file the information and come back up to the court. The fact is, getting back to, I think, Judge Smith, your question, if I can have a couple more seconds, I would agree that because the conduct predates the probation, the 1.3 violation vis-a-vis that probation, perhaps progressive discipline doesn't apply. However, we have a significant history, including a reprimand from this court, for 1.3 and 1.4, diligence and communication violations. And I do think the progressive discipline applies because of, even if you set aside the probation, because of that prior history. So we are asking for an actual suspension of a year in the case.
The ABA progressive discipline doesn't really contemplate state suspension, does it?
I don't think so, Judge.
I mean, that's just kind of an exception to the effect of a suspension, but progressive discipline would be after a reprimand suspension.
I think the ABA, I think you're right, I think the ABA assumes some sort of actual suspension. It's explanation of progressive discipline. Thank you.
May it please the court. I wish I could take credit for doing a good job at that disciplinary hearing in January in my office, but I would submit to the court, I think that disciplinary panel took into account who John Allen was, And I think they took into account the totality of the circumstances as well as the purpose and concept of progressive discipline. We're here because the OCDC basically has taken the position that they have not agreed with the sanctions of the disciplinary hearing panel. And that decision with regard to punishment was a 6-month suspension with a 1-year probationary period with conditions, which are very, very similar to the conditions in the Coleman case that was written by Judge Breckenridge 3 years ago under very similar circumstances. And the position, if I can posit it as follows, is that the discipline was inadequate because of the concept of progressive discipline and what is referred to as the egregious nature of the false and misleading affidavit and the failure to take actions to correct the affidavit before the court. I would posit that this position fails to take into account and does harm to the notion that each disciplinary case must be decided on its own facts and that sanctions cannot and should not be formulaic. In addition, it fails to give voice to the notion that the true purpose of discipline, something that hasn't come up yet, is not the punishment of the lawyer, but rather the protection of the public.
Well, in that vein, the protection of the public, isn't part of that the protection against the filing of false affidavits and these cases going on and all the expense that was incurred, whereas this would have been dismissed?
It is, Your Honor.
So and has he made any effort to pay the sanctions?
It is. But let me speak to that. And I hate to use this metaphor because it's overused about going into the weeds, but let me go into the weeds a little bit about the affidavit. I think it deserves a little attention. I think if you look at the record as what happened in front of the disciplinary hearing panel in January, there was absolutely no effort to evade or to lie or to cover anything up, and there's never been any cover-up with regard to the affidavit. So let me explain. The affidavit under the statute 538.225, I'm familiar with it, I've done it myself. The statute, as you know, has changed over the years. John named 3 doctors. He had a letter from one of the doctors that covered all of the defendants in the case. That's the core letter. It's part of the legal file. He named the 2 other doctors. One doctor, this started as a legal malpractice case, and a deposition of that doctor had been taken, and there was never any issue. The third doctor, Dr. Schmitz, John would say, and John said, was basically a neglect thing. What he did was he added it in the abundance of caution, as he said, a discovery aid. Was it sloppy? Yes. It was sloppy. Was it intentional? Absolutely not.
Does he think the statute lets him do that now? I mean, that's not what
No, the statute does do that now. No, when I say the statute's changed, and now you've got to actually show the report to the other side. Uh-huh. That's the change that has occurred in the last couple of years. So what happened here was he named this Dr. Schmitz, okay? He gets the Terre Haute, and a critical decision had to be made. Should I let this guy get deposed? John hadn't even been thinking about it. His thought process didn't really focus on the fact that this doctor was going to get asked in the deposition about his report. Now, let me stop right there. John had a letter from a doctor that implicated all of the defendants in the case. He didn't need this letter from Dr. Schmitz. And that's important because in looking at the progressive, and I'm segueing into this progressive discipline, looking at all of the factors, he didn't make this affidavit for fraudulent or deceitful purposes or to gain any advantages. He didn't need to do that. So when this all started to unravel at the deposition and this good defense lawyer went to the heart of the matter and asked, have you ever given a written opinion? And the doctor said, no, John turned, you know, all kinds of different colors, okay?
And Let me stop you there for a minute.
Yes.
Isn't it true that Dr. Schmitz was the only doctor whose expertise was germane to Dr. Matthews?
No, sir. Dr. Corrett gave an opinion as to all the doctors in the case, including this oncological radiation treatment. Dr. Corrett's letter speaks to all of the defendants in the case. Now,
but was he an expert in radiology and oncology?
He was an expert in radiology, not radiological oncology. So there may be an issue as well.
Oncology was the area of expertise of Dr. Matthews, correct?
But sometimes you can use an expert in a slightly different specialty if that expert can testify that he knows the standard of care. But we never got that far. Now, so then, if I may continue, then what happened was, on the way back in the car, Terre Haute, he immediately called Mr. Malkmus and said, gee, I really screwed up on this. And as Malkmus testified in his deposition, which is part of the record, he knew that John wasn't lying to him. He knew that John wasn't trying to be deceitful. But he did what I would have done. When I'm talking about Malkmus, he filed a motion to dismiss. So then what did John do? John gave Dr. Schmitz the records he should have given him in the first place to review, and he did obtain this letter from Dr. Schmitz that was appropriate. It's also part of the record. And by this time, Mr. Malkmus, and now we're into 2008, Mr. Malkmus filed a motion to dismiss. John dismissed the old lawsuit, refiled with the correct affidavit, and threw himself under the proverbial bus, if you will. He admitted it. Then, and never, ever, I don't think there's any allegation that he ever tried to cover anything up. So then what happened is this lawyer filed a motion to dismiss, had it heard. Okay, the judge in Phelps County sustained the motion, dismissed the lawsuit. John then appealed the case to the Missouri Court of Appeals and was successful. Court of Appeals overruled the order with regard to the dismissal of the case, and John said, don't sanction my client, sanction me.
I'm unclear why the case was then later dismissed. It just got too long and too expensive to prosecute, or because he had those affidavits and so forth at that point.
Well, that's that,
it,
I hate
the
to
issues
use this.
We need.
It really isn't.
Was it related
an
to this? I'm unclear if it was related to this alleged.
It really isn't. I mean, there was a settlement of the underlying case. Some of the doctors paid money.
Okay.
One of the doctors moved out of the jurisdiction, and it was decided for strategic purposes not to pursue Dr. Matthews. Okay.
Before your time's up, I'd like to address one issue.
Yes, sir.
Up to now, the respondent has never been sanctioned for any kind of conduct involving honesty or truthfulness or candor with the tribunal. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct.
Why should he receive basically the same punishment, for lack of a better word, probation and a stay, for something for his problems with diligence, or problems now that are dealing with honesty and truthfulness and candor to the tribunal?
Okay. I had intended to address that, Your Honor. And I will do that. But let me say this to you. Let me say what this case is not about. The law that is cited in the informant's brief talks about three different cases that involve dishonesty, subornation of perjury, taking money from clients' trust accounts, and that kind of thing. You're correct. Mr. Allen has never, ever had any problem with the bar with regard to any misrepresentation, any taint of dishonesty. All of the violations that you've had has to do with diligence and communication. I would submit to you that this is a diligence infraction, a diligence information. That's really the crux of it.
Mr. Pratzel suggests that he filed an affidavit that said he had a written affidavit from Dr. Schmitz.
He did say that.
When he did not have a written affidavit. That at the very least it has to be a knowing violation that he said something false in that. And how does that not fall within dishonesty?
I think there's a big difference in being dishonest and knowingly doing something that is inaccurate. That there was no intent to deceive or gain advantage. As I look at the term dishonest and I look at the case law cited, I think there's a huge difference.
If the doctor he said that he had an opinion of was one of the doctors that had a same or similar specialty as the defendant, why isn't there a reasonable inference that's why he didn't tell the truth about that?
Because he had a letter from another doctor.
Well, I understand. The other doctor, though, may not have been of the same or similar specialty. Well, so the issue, I guess the point is, to me there's objective proof that it was false. So the issue is there a reasonable inference that he did it for an evil motive, or is there a reasonable inference that he did it for a bad motive? The hearing panel found that he did it knowingly.
I can answer that easily.
I'm sure.
I don't, as you can probably guess, I don't think there is a reasonable inference that there was any intent to deceive or to lie to gain advantage in this lawsuit.
Then why did he say something that wasn't so?
Because he was sloppy. Because he was just playing sloppy.
And he thought he was about to get it, or he thought he had it and had checked it?
He thought he had it from another source and didn't need it. And he would say, and he said, it said it. Listen, I wasn't there. He said it to the tribunal, to the disciplinary hearing panel, that he did it sort of as an aid to discovery to let the other side know that he had these guys as experts. Now, when he got to Terre Haute and realized that the doctor hadn't formed an opinion, what he should have done, I don't think there's any secret. What he should have said, let's delay the deposition so you have the documents that you need to review. I wouldn't be standing here today.
It seems like to me you're taking the position that the punishment ought to be less for unnecessary lying than necessary lying. You're saying, Judge, well, he didn't need to lie, so don't punish him like he lied.
Judge, I don't look at this as a lie. I have to look you right in the eye. I don't.
How many times have you filed an affidavit since you've been a lawyer that says that you did something that you did not do?
Never. I knew you'd ask me that question. Nope. I've never done it. But I'm sorry, Judge.
What the indication he has problems with due diligence, he's sloppy. How do we protect the public? How is he going to be protecting the public from this time on if he continues to practice?
Judge Teitelman, you've known me for 40 years, and we were law school classmates, and you know that I wouldn't be standing up here if I thought that John Allen was a menace to the public or the public needed to be protected from John Allen. John Allen's been practicing law for 38 years. You know, we're all imperfect, and he's made mistakes along the way. I understand he has a history of diligence problems, but I can honestly say to you that the public,
does he have a new office manager? Does he have a different system of following up, a tickler system or something?
That was after the disciplinary hearing panel heard this for an entire day. That was the conditions of his probation that they suggested. You know, the very, very similar thing that Judge Breckenridge ordered in the Coleman case. A lot more safeguards than this other probation. But to answer your question, I really don't think that the purpose of this, and we can sit here all day about what happened in 2005 and 2006, but the public's interest is not going to be served. Here's a man that's got 30 or 40 active cases. You know, to suspend him now would be a bigger hardship on his clients, and it would do to punish him and take him out of a profession that he, you know, as I say, he hasn't been perfect at, but I think he's done a very good, incredible job at over all these years. I want to talk a little bit about this business about progressive discipline and what these other, and as Mr. Prossel pointed out, sort of the timing of this, the unfortunate timing of this. The discipline that you see is the six incidents are not linear. In other words, this last probationary period occurred after all of these operative events took place that we are discussing here today. So I don't think that it's exactly fair if you look at, you know, Rule 5, you know, 0.225, which is the rule that gives any disciplinary tribunal the right to put someone on probation, I think you need to consider the fact that this particular incident occurred and was resolved by the Court of Appeals after the probationary period ended. Again, Rule 5.225 does discuss about this concept of harm to the public, and it states that probation eligibility is appropriate if a lawyer can perform legal services without causing the courts or the profession to fall into disrepute. It's a very catch-all term, and I would submit to you that allowing John Allen to continue the practice of law even under probation, is not going to do harm to the profession. And certainly, he has not committed any act warranting disbarment.
Thank you.
I believe my, thank you.
I have 2 points I'd like to make very briefly. Judge Knatzer raises a very good point that counsel attempted to speak to, which is this: the allegations seem to be, well, he already had an opinion, so this was surplusage. He didn't need to put in Dr. Schmitz. But in fact, if you look at the statute 538.225 and track it with that affidavit, he didn't have what he needed, and he needed Dr. Schmitz as a radiologic oncologist.
We have issued opinions in the last couple of years which indicate that if you have experience in the area, whether or not you share the title, that if you in fact are expert because of what you do, you, for instance, do x-rays and understand x-rays and so forth, and that's the issue, is what the x-rays said, that can be sufficient. You don't have to be an oncologist. Whether that would apply here or not, I don't know, but
I totally understand, Judge. Yeah. But in this case, the statute says it defines a licensed healthcare provider as someone who practices in the same specialty as the defendant.
No, but we've interpreted that to mean your actual.
Okay. I'm not aware of that case, but if that's the case, that's fine.
As opposed to some external, medical association specialty,
I think that may be the case. But clearly, in this situation, he wasn't simply disclosing an additional expert as though it were discovery that someone was taking.
I agree.
He was knowingly trying to comply with the statute by saying he had something that he didn't have.
The one he had may or may not have been adequate, is what I'm saying.
Those opinions weren't public at the time. The
okay.
Right, absolutely.
So we won't hold you against it.
The other point I'd like to make is the question as to whether a respondent's clients end up dismissing their case against Dr. Matthews as a result of his misconduct. And I didn't quite catch what counsel was saying, but I want you to know exactly what a respondent testified to before the panel. And I'm looking at appendix pages 46 to 47, where Mr. Klinkhardt asks a respondent, and would you agree that they ultimately, they being his clients, had to dismiss their claims against Dr. Matthews? They have dismissed because of your filing a false affidavit. His answer, I'm sure it was the main thing, other than the expense of going forward with the case, but that was what catapulted everything out of whack. So it's clear that his client suffered significant damage in terms of their claim against Dr. Matthews by virtue of his actions in the case. We would ask that the court consider an actual suspension, not probation, in the case. Thank you
very much. The case will be taken under submission.